Today on the John Ankerberg Show, statistics show that about 70% of Christian young people who attend church regularly in high school will drop out or step away from their Christian faith when they leave to attend a secular college or university. Why are they leaving behind the faith in which they were raised? 32% of Christian students said they left their faith behind because of intellectual skepticism or doubt. Their faith didn't make any sense to them anymore, or there were too many questions they didn't think could be answered. 63% of teenaged Christians said they do not believe that Jesus is the Son of the one true God. 51% said they do not believe that Jesus rose from the dead. 68% said they do not believe that the Holy Spirit is a real entity. But I believe this trend can be reversed. My guest today, who will lead us through this discussion, is Dr. Daryl Bach, one of the leading historical Jesus scholars in our country and one of the world's foremost authorities on the Gospel of Luke and the Book of Acts. He is Senior Research Professor of New Testament Studies at Dallas Theological Seminary and has authored over 30 books and appeared on ABC, CNN, Fox, and the Discovery Channel. I invite you to join us for this special edition of the John Ankerberg Show. Welcome to our program. Let me ask you this question. What are the questions that your students need to know how to answer before you send them to the university in order for them to keep their faith in the Lord Jesus? When you send them to a secular university or college, there are critical professors that are talking to them about God, Bible, and Jesus, and they're not necessarily telling them what they've been hearing in church. And we're doing this program to try and prepare you and them for that experience, because you don't want them to lose their faith. One of the things is, when you hear a verse like John 3:16, "For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believeth in him should not perish, but have everlasting life." All right? Is that the true message of the Bible? Did that really come down from Jesus? Is it really based on historical facts? Is this something that's been changed along the line, or was it made up in the 4th century? There are a lot of accusations made, and we're trying to put you on solid bedrock here that what we have believed is true. And my guest is Dr. Daryl Bach. He's a professor, one of the leading historical Jesus scholars in our country. He's one of the world's foremost authorities on the Gospel of Luke and the Book of Acts. He's the Senior Research Professor of New Testament Studies at Dallas Theological Seminary and has appeared on ABC, CNN, Fox, the Discovery Channel, and most any time where they're looking for an evangelical to take on all of the critics, you will see Daryl sitting on the set. And Daryl, I'm glad that you're here today. And I want to get right down to this thing that people have said, you know, with the Gnostic Gospels, the Nag Hammadi finds, and all of these new little books that have come down, that these books have changed the way we believe, okay? These were the gospel that's been preached for 1900 years, okay? That's one version of Christianity. Now we realize there were other books in circulation and other ideas about Jesus, and they're saying they were just as acceptable in the sense that they were there. So how did this specific train of orthodoxy come all the way down to us? They're saying, well, there was a power play around the 4th century with the creeds, and the church imposed this and threw out all the other stuff, okay? You're saying that's not true, and you're telling us the reasons why, and you're saying one of the ways that you examine these documents is to find out, okay, you do have documents at certain times, 2nd, 3rd century, talking about Jesus, using the apostles' names, all kinds of stuff. They're not connected with the apostles, but they also aren't connected in terms of the message, the theology that's been apparent in the early church right from the get-go. The theology is completely different. And you're trying to tell us today, what's the core theology that the Bible's presented from the get-go? Then you can compare it with these others. And when the Christians did it in the early days, they said, that's not what we believe, and they discarded those books, okay? So tell us what's going on here.
Well, what we have is a core theology that passes through two centuries of conversation. I need to set the stage a little bit for what we're doing. Many of the university models will say that Irenaeus is the father of orthodoxy, that really the concept of establishing a canon and of pushing the idea of an orthodoxy and pushing others aside is a product that begins to emerge at the end of the second century and then works itself out into the fourth century.
So about 180
Irenaeus. About 180 in Irenaeus. And what I did years ago was to sit down and go through the doctrine of God, the doctrine of Jesus, and the doctrine of salvation, and go through and trace the writings before we get to Irenaeus, the so-called architect of this orthodoxy, and trace and see if there was a core theology that was consistently running through them. And I made the argument then that there was a core theology, and I think the best thing to do is to just read it.
Let's put it up on the screen for folks.
And the reason I'm going to do this is because when you hear it, it's not going to sound like a creed on the one hand. It doesn't sound like the Bible versus New Testament on the other, but it is dealing with the themes that the New Testament is presenting. Here I think is the summary. There was one creator God. Jesus was both human and divine. He truly suffered and was raised bodily. He is worthy to receive worship. Salvation was about liberation from hostile forces, but it also was about sin and forgiveness, the need to fix a flaw in humanity that made each person culpable before the Creator. This salvation was the realization of promises that God made to the world and to Israel through Israel's law and prophets. The one person, Jesus Christ, brought this salvation not only by revealing the way to God and making reconciliation, but by providing for that way through his death for sin. Resurrection into a new exalted spiritual life involves salvation of the entire person, spirit, soul, and very importantly, body. Faith in this work of God through Jesus saves and brings a spiritual life that will never end. That was the orthodoxy of the earliest tradition, and that's what this tour showed. It meant that there were certain things that were ruled out from the get-go in terms of orthodoxy. God was not to be divided in such a way that he was not the creator. He was the creator of all things, and that initial creation was good. A division between Jesus and the Christ in terms of his basic person and work was not acceptable. Orthodoxy was that Jesus, as Son of God, was sent from God and came truly in the flesh and truly suffered. And third, redemption only on the spiritual plane was not the true faith. Salvation included a physical dimension of resurrection and extended into the material creation. And this meant, fourth, that Jesus came not only to point the way to faith, to be a prophet, to be a teacher of religious wisdom, or to be an example of religious faith. Rather, his work provided the means to salvation. He was far more than a prophet. He was worshiped and affirmed, sharing glory with God as his Son. That is the core theology of the first two centuries. And you can pick virtually any substantial work of the first two centuries coming out of Christianity, out of this wing of Christianity, if you take it from the skeptical side, and you will hear and see that story.
Yeah. So if you're saying before Irenaeus at 180, you're looking at documents going back. You're saying you've got Jesus, you've got him recorded in the Gospels, you've got the letters of Paul that are even earlier than the Gospels. Then you got the disciples of the apostles, the guys that sat underneath the teaching when Peter would preach or Paul would preach or John would preach. You got those guys, their writings.
The speeches recorded in Acts.
The speeches in Acts. So you've got these things. And whether you look at what we call the 27 books of the New Testament or whether you look at the writings of the apostles' disciples, or you look at the fathers that came after that, right from the get-go, you find all of that, which you just said.
That's right. And the real key point here is that there's a consistency of theology running through all these sources. It's running over two centuries. You can see it again and again and again. It's expressed with some variety of terminology and with some variety of emphasis. But that core story is what is being told and is what is being passed on. You'll notice it's not quite the language of the creeds, because the creeds are going to develop what is here. And it's not quite the language necessarily of individual passages of the New Testament, because what we're seeing is the synthesis of what those texts are doing out of the New Testament and the way they were conceiving kind of the whole big picture story.
All right, in a moment we're going to take them through some of the texts and let them see that these words are actually there. But switch hats, okay? Let's say that a kid comes into the classroom at the university and you're the critical professor, okay? So everybody assume that Daryl's not a Christian, but he's studied these books and he's got a different idea, and he's responding to what you just said. How would he respond?
Well, I think the emphasis would be that there would be a way to try and challenge the earliness of what it is that I'm suggesting. They can't challenge the fact that it's there. It's there. So the question is, how far back does it go? And does it actually put us in contact with Jesus? They're going to emphasize this gap that we've talked about and which stuff's going on. And they're going to argue that what we're seeing in the sources, yeah, it may have a first century pedigree. It may even have a pedigree that's better than these other sources that we're talking about that are later. That's true. But we still haven't touched the finger of the sources to the finger of Jesus.
Yeah, but their gap's only 20 to 40 years. So, I mean, it's not like we got a big gap here. And the thing is, you do have Christians establishing churches all around the empire, and you got hymns and you got other things happening.
And you got the theology and the core tradition that is going back to the very experiences that come on top of the events. This is what we mentioned in the last show. So what we've tried to do is to show this gap that is portrayed as being where so much can happen actually is somewhat an exaggerated figment of the imagination if we're talking about the contents of what we're talking about. Yes, the sources are that much later than the events, but what's feeding into the sources and the tradition that's feeding into the sources and the stories that are feeding into the sources, you can push them back and close that gap.
Yeah. All right, we're going to take a break, and we're going to let you think about that for about 30 seconds, and we'll be right back. And I'm going to show you the verses where some of the thoughts that Daryl just gave to us, where they came out of, which go back right to the original sources. People might want to say, I need some earlier sources, but these are the earliest sources. When you get down to the 27 books of the New Testament, that's as far as you can go back.
Yeah, what we're arguing is that the pedigree that comes out of these materials, I'm going to say it this way, that happen to be in the Bible, okay, are actually our best and earliest sources for being in touch with what the first century movement was about.
Yeah, well, we're going to give the Bible, and we can also give some quotes from the fathers and so on. We're going to show the sources that are there. This is the theology that they've got. All right, stick with us. We'll be right back.
You're listening to The John Ankerberg Show. If you would like to have today's show, it's available on audio CD or MP3 by calling our toll-free line at 1-800-805-3030. Just ask for offer R243. If you would like to have all three programs in this series on DVD, they are available as well. Just ask for offer R244. That number again is 1-800-805-3030. That's 1-800-805-3030.
All right, we're back. And the information we're talking about today, I wish somebody had told me before I entered into college. Because I can remember going into a secular university, University of Illinois, and I had professors that knew that I was a Christian, and they would ask me, well, why do you believe this? And then they would take some of the things that I hadn't studied yet, and they would use it against me. And part of this thing was, did the theology change? Was it made up by Christians after Jesus lived and they invented a new Jesus? Or was it just jammed down everybody's throat by the church councils in the fourth century? Well, as a kid coming in, you don't know that, and I had to go and study and find that out. But if you're sending your son or daughter to the university and they don't know how Christianity began, they don't know why the truths that we hold have solid evidence to back them up, when they get to the university, they're in trouble. This is why our Christian students, raised in church, go to these universities, and all of a sudden they lose their faith. Now, Daryl is a scholar that's known around the world, and he's helping us unscramble this. And we talked about how this theology, the core beliefs of Christianity, are seen not only in the 27 books of the New Testament, but they're seen in the disciples of the apostles and then the church fathers later on. Just about any place you look, there's a core theology that runs through all of them. But I want to take it back to the 27 books here for a moment. Everybody, both friends and enemies, knew about Jesus' trial. You see this on the documentaries, you see this in the movies and so on. And Jesus is on trial, and the high priest asks him this question, and this is in Mark 14, 61, 62. Are you, Jesus, the Messiah? Are you the Messiah, the Christ, the Son of God? He called the Blessed One. And Jesus said, I am. And then he says, and you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One and coming on the clouds of heaven. They said, okay, what else do we need? That's blasphemy. He's worthy of death. Okay? Now, that's a statement that everybody knew. What is it saying about Jesus?
Well, let's work from the crucifixion back, because the crucifixion is an event that, unless you are extremely skeptical, you know took place in history. Most people recognize that Jesus was crucified under Pontius Pilate. Not only does the New Testament tell us this, but Josephus tells us this in Antiquities 18:63 and 64. Tacitus tells us this in Annals 15:44. So we have extra biblical corroboration for this event. You get crucified for sedition. Sedition means that Jesus, and the Titulus in the gospel says that Jesus was crucified for claiming to be king of the Jews. The Romans had a view about kings. We appoint the kings, you don't. And they believed in law and order. You follow our law or we'll put you in order. And crucifixion was the way of putting things in order. So Jesus was crucified for sedition. Now, when we work back to this trial and the question about the Messiah, the skeptics will come along and say, how do we know this is really what took place? Jesus is the only one who's there. Remember, you're in a naturalist worldview, so they aren't thinking about a raised Jesus who can report what happened to him at the trial. But there still are ways to find out what happened at the trial. Nicodemus, Joseph of Arimathea, close members of the council would have known. Paul, as a persecutor of the church originally, he would have known what the official Jewish position against Jesus would have been because he was advocating it at one time. So you had the debate between the family of Annas and the family of Jesus. One of Annas' descendants is responsible for James's death in the 60s. That's a 30-year family feud happening in Jerusalem, a city of somewhere between 25 to 75,000, with the debate going on about who represents the truth about where Judaism is headed. Between this new movement and what the priests represent. So all this gives opportunity for what happened at the trial to come out and to be a part of what was going on. And so what that claim is not only am I Messiah, but I am Son of Man. Now, Son of Man happens to be a very important title. It's in all the levels of the tradition that feed our Gospels. That's one of the criteria that we use for authenticity, what's called multiple attestation.
Shows up 82 times Jesus uses it about
himself. And it's a peculiar use of the term because Jesus uses it of himself. The early church doesn't use it of Jesus in the epistles. They don't refer to him that way. It's Jesus' way of referring to himself. It draws on the picture of Daniel 7. Daniel 7 is an unusual passage because even though the Son of Man is a human being, Son of Man means son of a human being, just like David's son would mean David's son and Charlotte's daughter would mean Charlotte's daughter, but he rides the clouds. Only deity rides the clouds in the Old Testament. So you've got this human being doing stuff that God does. And not only that, he comes and he receives authority from the Ancient of Days and shares in the judgment. So what Jesus is claiming is the right to sit with God in heaven, to share authority, to share responsibility for salvation. He is a vice regent in every sense of that term. And in the Judaism of the time, Second Temple Judaism, God shared his glory with no one. God is one. And so the idea of being able to share your glory with God was a challenging thought. And because the Jewish leadership had this view, they thought that Jesus was blaspheming. But what he was saying was, you may do to me with me whatever you want. You might even crucify me and put me to death. But one day God's going to vindicate me. And when that tomb goes empty, I know that I am still alive and one day I will be your judge. And if you want to contact me, you can contact me at www.righthandofgod.com. In other words, God is going to vote into this dispute, and the resurrection is the vote on that dispute. So this is a claim of authority. It's a claim of authority that goes back to Jesus. It's a claim of authority that goes back to Jesus in the midst of his ministry. It tells you about the character of his ministry. It tells you what the disciples believed, and where, at least it's one evidence of where they got it from.
Yeah, and he uses that Son of Man has the right to forgive sins.
And in Mark 2, very early on, when he heals a paralytic, he uses something that you cannot see. You can't see forgiveness of sins with something you can see, healing a paralytic. And when that paralytic gets up, he says, in order that you might know that the Son of Man has authority on earth to forgive sins, I say to you, get up and walk. And when he walks, his walk talks and says, the Son of Man has authority on earth to forgive sins. And forgiving sins is something only God can do. So we've got another divine human cross here that's happening in, this is important, in the Synoptic Gospels. Some of the skeptics claim that the Synoptic Gospels don't have the high theology that John's Gospel does. Well, John's Gospel has a high theology and says it explicitly, but it's implicit in the Synoptic Gospels in what it is that Jesus is doing, that he's showing who he is and making claims about who he is by what he's doing.
That's why I love the illustration of John the Baptist. Are you the one that we're expecting? Is there somebody else? And the answer that Jesus gives says it all.
Exactly right. He says, you know, the blind see, the lame walk, the gospel is declared to the poor, the dead are raised. Most of these are phrases out of Isaiah that talk about what God's going to do when the time of salvation comes. He says, you can know who I am by what I do.
All right, Daryl, the fact of Jesus saying that can be proven so many different ways by the skeptics themselves, as well as believers, the Jews, the Romans. You have recordings of this in going different directions. So you can see that. The question is, how is the message transmitted down through the years? What did Jesus foresee would happen and what did he set up?
Well, what Jesus is doing is he's presenting himself as being at the center of the program of God, when actually when he's being confessed as Messiah, what he's being confessed as being is being the anointed one who brings the salvation of God. He's at the hub of what God is doing. And the exaltation tells you who this figure is. So that's what he's setting up. And what we're seeing and what we've seen is this gap that supposedly exists between events and sources is shrinking to the point where we're actually into the events themselves related to Jesus's activity for the explanation for the message of the theology that's coming out of it. So we literally have compressed this gap down, and now this gap actually almost doesn't even exist anymore. It doesn't mean that there isn't development in how the thought is expressed and in the various ways of talking about it, but the core idea that Jesus is the central figure of salvation through whom salvation revolves, that's in what Jesus is doing and saying, and the disciples pick that up as witnesses. So we don't have competing theologies. What we have is the development of this core theology being expressed with some variety of emphasis between the various writers because they're highlighting different aspects of it.
Yeah, but I like that. They picked it up as witnesses. Not only did they pick it up, but Jesus picked them out and then commanded them to go and tell the folks that they made disciples all the other things that he told the apostles.
This is the message that came from the earliest generations of people who are with Jesus or people who are around the people with Jesus.
It's solid evidence. It all goes together. And I hope that you're grasping what we're talking about. And we're going to go on and talk about not only how did the witnesses go out and talk, but how did their disciples record what they said? And, you know, how did we get the Bible? Were the books picked out? People want to know, who picked out the books and why those books? And some are saying, well, why did they leave those out? We're going to talk all about that as we go into these next programs. I hope that you'll join us then.
You're listening to the John Ankerberg Show. If you would like to have today's show, it's available on audio CD or MP3 by calling our toll-free line at 1-800-805-3030. Just ask for offer R243. If you would like to have all three programs in this series on DVD, they are available as well. Just ask for offer R244. That number again is 1-800-805-3030. 3030. That's 1-800-805-3030.
Thank you for joining us for this edition of the John Ankerberg Show. For more information about today's series, please contact us at 1-800-805-3030 or visit us online at jashow.org. That's jashow.org.